I'm very gratified that you're doing a program on the six C's because, well, we had a little gathering before earlier today, and a group of students, 15 or 20 students, and I asked them the question of how much was taught to them in high school about the 60s, and the answer was close to nothing. And so I think it's a very important thing that's being done. It's an interesting question as to one, why the 60s is being shunted aside on the one hand, or when it's not shunted aside, that is when it's dealt with, why is it distorted? That is, why is the picture that's given to us of the 60s, and this is a picture I get when occasionally I see something about the 60s or see a reference to the 60s, the picture I get of the 60s is drug-crazed kids racing through the streets, throwing stones and breaking windows. That's the 60s. Well, it's not the 60s I knew. It's not the 60s most people who were involved in the 60s knew. But there's a kind of hysteria that has developed about the 60s and about what the 60s have wrought in American society, because there's no doubt the 60s had a very serious effect on American society. And the question is, what has that effect been? And there are people who don't like that effect, who think that the 60s ruined everything. No, and I mean, here's Hilton Kramer. Don't ask me who Hilton Kramer is. I like to pick out names, you know. I made it up, okay? He's actually an art critic who was writing in the New York Times and very angry about the 60s. He was talking about the National Endowment for the Humanities, you know, getting angrier and angrier. And said, our woeful decline in literary and academic standards is in the context of the more general assault on mind and intelligence as a result of the radical social and political movements of the 60s. Well, here's George Will. Maybe you've heard of George Will. No? Yeah, well, I never heard of George. Well, yes, I confess I must. He talks about how all this argument that's going on about curriculum, what should be taught, should we have multicultural studies, should we have unicultural studies, should we have black studies, should we have only white studies? What kind of a curriculum, he says, these disagreements over curriculum are related battles in a single war, a war of aggression against the Western political tradition. I mean, those are scary terms. When you have a war of aggression, you mobilize armies. And this is a war of aggression against the Western political tradition. And Alan Bloom. How many people here have heard of Alan Bloom? Yeah. So he does exist. I didn't make him up. He actually, about, I don't know, 10 years or so ago, wrote a bestseller called The Closing of the American Mind. He was furious about the 60s. He was just in a state of hysteria about the 60s. The 60s frightened him. I mean, here he was teaching his little seminar at Cornell. When I say little, I'm not trying to demean it by, you know, saying it wasn't an important seminar. No, I mean, there were just a few people in it. May have been a very important, it was about Plato and Aristotle. He was a political philosopher. And he was absolutely furious that his little seminar on Plato and Aristotle was being disturbed by the crowds of students out on the campus protesting against racism and against the war. Something was happening to civilization, and he didn't like it. He said, the democratization of the university that came out of the 60s led to the collapse of the entire American educational structure. He must be talking about us. I mean, I look around, I say, it's collapsed, right? I mean, and here's another member of the National Association of Scholars, which shouldn't fool you, it's an association. But, well, he says, the barbarians are in our midst. Again, talking about the people who are introducing, as a result of the educational changes of the 60s, people are introducing new things into the curriculum. And, you know, the same Alan Bloom who wrote The Closing of the American Mind was very annoyed that history was being taught in a different way. That people were actually teaching a history in which there was criticism of the development of American civilization. And he says, the American tradition is unambiguous. Now, if it's unambiguous, it means it only has one meaning, and he will tell us what it is. America tells one story, the unbroken, ineluctable progress of freedom and equality. From its first settlers and its political foundings on, there has been no dispute that freedom and equality are the essence of justice for us. Now read that statement to Native Americans, or read that statement to black people, or read that statement to women, or read that statement to working people who are very conscious of the fact that the, you know, development of the United States and development of American society has been a development on the backs of working people. With all the good things that you can say about it. He says, the radicals in the civil rights movement succeeded in promoting a popular conviction that the founding was and the American principles are racist. Well, he objects to the idea that the founding fathers were racist just because they were slave owners. I mean, they were slave owners, but not racists. Or, I mean, is it too much for us to take as Americans to take a very hard look at the founding fathers and simply agree that the founding fathers set up a constitution that legitimized slavery? Can't we accept that? That's hard to take. I remember during the bicentennial celebrations of 1987, when they were celebrating the 200 years after the, you know, the making of the Constitution back in 1787 in Philadelphia, and there was huge amount of, well, you know what happens in bicentennials. People go wild with, adulation of whatever it is they're celebrating, and so the founding fathers became gods, actually, literally. I say literally because at that time Ronald Reagan wrote an essay. It's hard to believe that Ronald Reagan would write an essay, but maybe someone wrote an essay and signed his name, or maybe he looked over someone's shoulder and copied an essay, you know. But Ronald Reagan wrote an essay for a scholarly journal, a Parade magazine. and it was about the Constitution. And in it, I'm sorry, I don't have it with me. I like to carry Ronald Reagan quotes around with me. It's just do my heart good. But in it, Ronald Reagan said, our Constitution was made so perfectly that it could only have been made by the guiding hand of God. And, well, that same year of the celebration of the bicentennial of the making of the Constitution, that same year, there was one public voice that spoke out against the general adulation of the founding fathers, and that was the voice of Thurgood Marshall, Justice of the Supreme Court, the only black member of the Supreme Court, and he made a speech in which he said, sorry, I can't join in the general celebration for a document that established slavery as a legal right of those states that had slavery. He was doing the same thing that had been done back before the Civil War by Frederick Douglass, when Frederick Douglass was asked to give a speech celebrating the 4th of July. Frederick Douglass, you may know, the the former slave who became a great leader, orator, writer of the anti-slavery movement, one of the giant figures of American history. He was asked to give a speech celebrating the 4th of July. And the speech he gave for the 4th of July did not please his listeners. He said, what does your 4th of July mean to us? You know, to you it may mean freedom. To us it means something else. Anyway, there's always hysteria, as I say, about what the 60s have wrought, what they did to our history. There was even a point at which somebody suggested, well, not just somebody, I shouldn't say that, two psychiatrists. No, a psychiatrist and a neurosurgeon, I should get them right. From Harvard, I got that right. This was after the great upheavals in American cities in 1968 that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King. And some of you may remember, you read that after the assassination of King, there were upheavals in cities all over the country in reaction against that. And the police came in, as the police usually come in, and do what the police usually do, you see. And there were people who resisted the police and people who fought back against the police. And these two, this neuropsychiatrist and neurosurgeon from Harvard, wrote a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association proposing a surgical strategy to prevent protesters from resisting the police. Does this sound strange to you? Nothing is strange. I mean, we live in a strange world. I mean, nothing is outlandish, right? I mean, I read some of these things and I say, no, I'm making this up. No, I'm not making this up. You know, they said that these people who quote, violently resisted police control were suffering from brain dysfunction, a condition they said that could be remedied by psychosurgery. At that time, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California. He immediately seized upon this idea, and he prepared to allocate $1 million to set up a violence reduction center. And in fact, in a California prison, they actually perform 50 such operations using prisoners as guinea pigs. And the prisoners ended up as vegetables. This is one of those lost little episodes in American history. But it's worth recalling just to know what is possible. The question is, Why either the hiding of the 60s, the obliteration of that history, or the distortion of the history? Why is it important? That's 30 years ago. That's history. And I suppose the answer is, anytime anybody gets excited about the interpretation of a past event, it's not because of the past event. It's not because they want to straighten out what happened in the past, you know, just for the record. No, that's not why people get excited. People get excited about past events because of the present, because something is happening in the present, something that they care very much about, and they want a certain picture of a past event because it supports the positions that they take in the present. I mean, why do people get excited about the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima? That's a 50-year history. Why still argue about should the bomb have been dropped? Right? You can't. It's too late to do anything about whether too late to do anything about the people of Hiroshima. So why argue about that? Why such a furious argument? And why, when they set up an exhibit at the Smithsonian, which is going to show the suffering of the Japanese people under the bomb, there's immediate protest, and they remove the parts of the exhibit that show the suffering of the Japanese people and just show the dropping of the bomb as a kind of heroic and necessary act. Why do they do that? Not just because they want to straighten out the record of what happened in 1945, I think, but because they don't want people to get the idea that atomic weapons should be done away with. Because people, right? There's still a powerful need among certain circles of this society and others, a powerful need to hold on to this deadly weaponry and not to let its name be sullied by suggesting that any use of this weapon is an act of genocide. So the hysteria over the 60s has a present motivation. And a clue to what this present motivation is, when you look at just after the 60s end, in 1975, yeah, you may think my mathematics is a little off, but when I think of the 60s, I think of a 20-year period. I think of the 60s as being a period from the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 to the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And one of the really remarkable periods of American history. And at the end of this period, there was a kind of soul-searching. If some of these people who were searching really had souls, we'd call it soul-searching. But there was a kind of searching for, you know, what did this mean? And so a Harvard political scientist, I'm picking on Harvard tonight. Shouldn't do that, should I? It will be found out. I mean, I live there. I live in the same town as Harvard. People will learn that I said something bad about Harvard. I will be expelled from the city, right? A Harvard political scientist named Samuel Huntington, who was an advisor to, you know, the White House in the Vietnam era. You can imagine what kind of advice he gave. Wrote a report on what had just transpired in this era of the 60s. He wrote a report for the Trilateral Commission, which is a very high-level, kind of semi-secret outfit that represented the financial and political and military establishment of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan. I must speak about it in hushed tones. It was that kind of a thing. Actually, it was the kind of thing you would see in a James Bond movie. See Goldfinger, you know, get an idea of the Trilateral Commission, you see. Those kind of things. He's writing a report for them. And he's writing about the 60s, and he calls his report The Democratic Distemper. That's an interesting distemper. Isn't that bad? Isn't distemper bad? The Democratic Distemper. What does he mean? Here's what he means. The essence of the democratic surge of the 1960s was a general challenge to existing systems of authority. In one form or another, this challenge manifested itself in the family, the university, business, public associations, politics, the government bureaucracy, the military services. People no longer felt the same obligation to obey those whom they had previously considered superior to themselves in age, rank, status, expertise, character, or talents. That sounds good to me. People no longer felt an obligation to obey those who were they had previously considered superior to them. Huntington isn't happy about this. He says, this, quote, produced problems for the governability of democracy in the 1970s. It's interesting, another interesting expression, the governability of democracy. Democracy isn't a phenomenon that comes out of the desire and action of the people. Democracy has to be governed, and he's worried about whether democracy can be governed. He says, the question necessarily arises, if a new threat to security should materialize in the future, a new threat to security. Now, what was the old threat to security? Vietnam. That was a threat to our security. Now, we may have a new threat to our security. If a new threat to security should materialize in the near future, as it inevitably will at some point, the government will possess the authority to command the resources as well as the sacrifices which are necessary to meet that threat. That's what he's worried about. If people, as a result of what happened in the 60s and the movements of the 60s, get the idea that they should not simply be obedient to authority, that they should not simply accept the word of experts, they should not simply accept the word of the President of the United States or the Congress of the United States about what is happening, but they should think for themselves and look for information for themselves, well, that would create a problem. What if we want to have another war? What if they want to have another war? And people are that way. And he said that there had developed, and this is his language, an excess of democracy. Well, exactly what Huntington was worried about, this excess of democracy, to me, has a different meaning. To me, the 60s was a period in which democracy came alive. Because democracy is not simply a structure of government. I remember, growing up and going to junior high school and them talking about, democracy and how they presented democracy. What was democracy? Democracy was our form of government. And what was that? And it was, they put it on the board. They put a diagram on the board, the three branches of government. You must have seen that same, right? The legislative and the executive and the judicial and there's checks and balances and there's division of powers and it was beautiful. And that's democracy. And in that, the system is so beautifully worked out, the checks and balances so intricately designed, so that all you have to do is, go to the polls every 2 or 4 years and vote for somebody who will play an important part in that structure. And besides that, you don't have to do anything. I remember that John Updike, the novelist, let's see, is he also a Harvard man? I'm desperately looking for somebody I can attack who is not a Harvard man. John Updike, the novelist, really a very, very talented novelist. I have to say this before I denounce him. I won't denounce him. I'll just comment slightly. But Updike said that... this was in his memoir. He wrote a memoir some years ago. And he said, I didn't vote. This is a paraphrase because, as I told you, he's a very good writer. I can't match him. I can only paraphrase him in my inelegant way. But this is roughly, you have to take my word for what he said. He said, I didn't vote for Dr. Spock. I didn't vote for Abby Hoffman. I didn't vote for Dan Berrigan. I didn't vote for William Sloan Coffin. I didn't vote for any name, Joan Baez. I didn't vote for any named a bunch of leaders of the anti-war movement. I didn't vote for them. I voted for Lyndon Johnson. And that gave me the right not to make another political decision for the next 4 years. What a crippled view of democracy. Of course, it also tells you something about education, about that is our, a literary mind, and they're the experts, there is Huntington, they're the people with the PhDs, they're the Phi Beta Kappas, they're the best and the brightest. And what do they have to say? He voted for Lyndon Johnson, but he almost forgot, or did he forget, that when he voted for Lyndon Johnson in 1964, Lyndon Johnson pledged that he would not send boys to fight in a land war in Asia. And then Lyndon And so he had fulfilled his obligation by voting for Lyndon Johnson. Then he didn't have to make a decision. And then if the president violated his pledge not to send boys to Asia, and if then huge numbers of people died as a result of the violation of that pledge, then the job of John Updike as a citizen is simply to sit back and wait for the next election while the deaths still go on in Vietnam of Americans and of Vietnamese. Well, what happened in the 60s, as I say, you know, democracy came alive. People realized that the structure of government that had been laid out on the blackboard was really not sufficient to solve very fundamental problems of injustice. And the first movement to recognize that and to act upon that was the civil rights movement. And it was very clear that the history of black people in this country makes it very clear that Americans cannot depend on the normal structure of government to solve deep problems of injustice. Slavery was not done away with by constitutional means. And it was not even done away with just by President Lincoln issuing an Emancipation Proclamation or Congress passing the 13th Amendment. Slavery was done away with by the growth of an enormous anti-slavery movement in this country, which grew from a handful of people in the 1830s to a national movement in the 1860s and put pressure on Lincoln and put pressure on the Congress to finally bring about an end to slavery, and then to bring about the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. And then, even after that was done, even after those amendments were passed, even after the 14th Amendment seemed to promise equality, equal protection of the laws, no person shall be denied of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, for a powerful weapon against what any state might do to deprive anybody of liberty or equality. And that weapon was put aside by every single national administration. Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, it didn't matter. Every single national administration from the end of the Civil War to the 1960s simply did not enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments. Every president in that entire almost 100-year period violated his oath of office because he pledged to see to it when he took his oath of office that the laws of the United States, that the Constitution will be faithfully executed. But the 14th Amendment was ignored, and racial segregation was allowed to continue in the South, and violence and murder were allowed to continue, and the federal government looked the other way. The problem of racism and the problem of lynching and the problem of violence and all of that was not simply a Southern problem. It was not simply we had that was the way it was in the South and different in the North. It was a national problem, and the federal government collaborated continually for a long period of time. And none of the existing elements of that structure of government that was so neatly laid out for us on the blackboard of our junior high school classes, none of that sufficed to change this situation until black people themselves in the South, in the toughest place, in the worst places, in the most dangerous places, in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana, South Carolina, when black people in that most dangerous of situations rose up and created an enormous movement, a movement that swept the country, a movement that then was heard about and seen on television screens and heard on radios all over the world, and that embarrassed the government of the United States and finally began to bring about some changes in how the federal government was reacting to segregation and racial violence in the South. Now, that was democracy. When people were getting arrested, when people were demonstrating, when people were facing the fire hoses in Birmingham, when in the year 1963, 13,000 people were arrested in the first 10 weeks, when in the whole year of 1963, demonstrations took place in 800 Americans.